Okay. Again, we're on schedule. And so next up is General Electric. Vic Abbate, the Italian way you pronounce it, but he does like I do with Vic Abbate, is here, Vice President of Renewables for GE Power and Water. So, Vic, why don't you go ahead and come on up and take it from there.
Yeah, there's a clicker right there for you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. Appreciate the opportunity to spend a few minutes and talk to you about GE's energy business, and in particular, our renewable energy business. Just 30 seconds on my background. I've been with GE Energy for 20 years. Actually, April 9th will be my 20-year anniversary. So I've been in energy the whole time. Prior to this role, which I took in 2005, I was the vice president for technology in power generation. So big thermal background and technical background. And the reason I kick off with that is I think it's really telling on the strategy that the company has in this whole alternative energy space, which is really one around differentiating ourselves with technology and moving more technical resources into leadership positions as we push down this path. I'll just kick off with a slide that shouldn't be new to anybody here, but sets the framework for the macro trends. When you look at the space we're in, what excites us is, you know, electricity demand between now and 2030, we all know is expected to double. So we're in a growth market. Population continues to grow, 8 billion people by 2030. The environment, 73 countries now have mandates, renewable portfolio targets, and are installing alternative energy as a part of their core strategy. And from a security perspective, just the heightened energy concerns around the world. And so from our view, the both changing and growing energy needs are really driving new opportunities for us in General Electric. And it's a big part of our whole eco-imagination theme as we push forward. To ground you, I came down this morning on the train from Schenectady, New York, which is where the company started over 120 years ago. So we have a deep, rich heritage in power generation and the energy business. You can see the various technologies. What is renewables? Today, it's our wind and solar business. That's what I run. The business has grown from 2002 when we acquired this business from Enron, the wind side, for $250 million to over $6 billion in 08 and 09. So just tremendous growth, and we'll talk about that. But it's all predicated on pulling in the expertise from our core business. Just a couple slides here on the market. As we see it, if you look at the 2000 to 2009, wind essentially and solar doubled every 3 years consistently for the last decade. So it was a massive shift. Why was that happening? The whole world was diversifying their energy portfolio into alternative sources, and you could see this from 4 to 8 to 17 and 42 last year, $90 billion industry. What drove that was technology, cost, and policy. And I'll just take a second there, because if you go back to the 80s and 90s, and in particular wind, what you'll find is the cost of wind power dropped over 80% over the last 25 years. So wind now, depending on where you put it, between 6 and 12 to 13 cents a kilowatt hour for most land projects today is where that industry is. And that was driven from technology. One of our first observations and why we decided to enter this space was if you went out to California, historically one of the states leading alternative energy, and in particular wind, two out of three turbines weren't running 5 years after they were put up. And we felt we could make a big difference in the reliability of the technology. And with alternative energy, the fuel's free. So the main event now is reliability, and that's where we could differentiate. Also, policy. Clearly, with the production tax credit in the U.S., with the energy directive in the European Union, renewable energy law in China, countries are pushing this as well. And so that was really the driver over the last decade. So what's it look like in the next decade? Well, let's put it in perspective. If you look at the bottom right here, for every point that the world wants to diversify or be more renewable, If you were going to do that or accomplish that with wind, you need 40,000 more wind turbines. Last year, we had over a $6 billion business, around 3,000 wind turbines. So you can see what this means as far as the volume and value as the world continues to move this way. If you were going to do it with solar, for every point of target you'd hit with solar, it's 500 million solar modules. So this is a product demand cycle that is going to run for quite some time in our view. Have some bumps, it'll have ups and downs, but at the end of the day, this is a repeat product business, and so the best product's going to win, and that's what we're focused on. Today, the world's about 4% renewable penetration today, so significant growth ahead when you look at targets like 20% in many, many big countries around the world. So what's been our play to date? As I said earlier, it's all product leadership. So on the wind side, the machine we bought from Enron in 2002 is not the machine that we deliver today, and that's where we've been able to differentiate ourselves. Where if you take the U.S. market, which was the number one market of growth, second half of the last decade, one out of two turbines that landed in this country were General Electric. And the reason is, if you look on the left, technology. Capacity factor, which is really a measure for efficiency, we've moved that 13 points from the machine we bought from Enron in 2002. The availability of Enron's machine was about 85%. Today, our fleet runs at 98%, so 13 points of improvement there. Advanced grid expertise. Alternative energy technologies would typically frustrate system operators and utilities because any grid disturbance would drive it to protect itself, and it would jump offline and exacerbate the grid disturbance. In 2005, we introduced zero-voltage ride-through, something that actually keeps our turbines online and is a differentiator because it stabilizes the grid should a coal plant come offline. And if you look at the IP space, we have more patents filed than the next three competitors combined and are continuing to invest in this technology. And we've put over $1 billion since we entered the space in 2002. So what does that mean if you're a developer? In 02, the turbine we bought could power 420 homes. Today, that same turbine is 600 homes. So that's how it plays out, and that's the value that we can capture in price as we help our customers be more successful, but 40% more power output. And we've been able to scale this business, which when you actually look at what that means, in 2005, we were building about 10 turbines a week. The last 2 years, we were building 13 a day. And so this becomes a mass production where now we have over 13,500 1.5-megawatt machines. That's how you get quality. That's how you get reliability. That's how you get cost. And we believe from our supply chain perspective, that's how we've been able to differentiate ourselves. But when I talk to customers, they all recognize in financing institutions that the GE 1.5-megawatt is the industry workhorse. And that was our strategy as we executed in this business. We've also expanded the portfolio with a 2.5-megawatt machine, something we've spent $100 million of R&D money on. We started that back in 06 and really focused on launching it in Europe where there's more land-constrained sites. But this product is 55% more output than the 1.5-megawatt, 100-meter rotor and 100-meter tower, and really is targeted for Europe, but we're bringing it also into the U.S. with a recent announcement. For this product, we have over $4 billion of commitments. Two that are worth noting here. One is Caithness. This is the world's largest wind farm. It'll be 338 of these 2.5-megawatt machines up in Oregon, power 845 megawatts of power, and the installation begins next year. So we're excited about that. And we also have in Europe the largest wind project in Europe. It was the largest to date when we did that one, but 240 2.5-megawatt machines in Romania. So Eastern Europe has got a lot of growth, and it's a 600-megawatt project there, and we're in the process of installing that. So tremendous positioning here, both on the 1.5-megawatt and the 2.5-megawatt machine. With that, with the installed base, as we built out the platform, you can see how our fleet's performing from a reliability perspective. And I want to take a minute on this because it is at the core of our strategy. In 06, 1.5-megawatt fleet was 94% available, which meant 6% of the time turbines weren't ready to run. And remember, the fuel's free, so it's all opportunity cost if you don't have the turbine ready to perform. Today, 98%. every point of availability is worth $250 million to the owners of those assets. So we've created $1 billion of value on behalf of our customers by helping them and working through technology and controls improvements to make our fleet run better. And our whole tagline is the world's best running fleet. This is how we're going to differentiate ourselves and continue to do so. It's how we did it in gas turbines, it's how we've done it in steam turbines, and this is how we're going to do it in the alternative energy space. And so to do that, you've got to be smarter, faster, and better. And the way to think about it is, for one point of global penetration of alternative energy, it's 40,000 wind turbines. How do you manage that? You can't manage it in a distributed fashion. You have to be centralized. You need remote monitoring and diagnostics. You need technology. And we've invested in remote monitoring center, our headquarters in Schenectady, New York. I can start or shut down or tell you the status of any turbine on the planet. We also have one in Europe and are going to build one in Asia. So when you start to look at that capability, before somebody even gets to a turbine, we can tell them what part they need, what issues need to be solved, and as a result have the lowest return to service cycle time as well as the lowest trips per turbine per week, something that I personally at my level review every week for the entire fleet, which is something that our customers measure, and it's really the key to the success of getting the best return they can on those assets. Over 350 reliability engineers, this is what they do, and the ability to learn from this fleet. Again, on our 7F gas turbines, with over 1,000 of them out in the field, we're able to see things with Weibull curves and technology predictors that can help our customers be more successful. So it's a tremendous fleet that you'd want to invest in as a developer. And rigor and speed, and you can see the quote from Newsweek relative to a wind farm in Asia where, you know, when asked, the operator clearly commented that GE was the best running fleet, and he had a wind farm that had dozens of different suppliers, both domestic in China as well as international suppliers. So where's the next wave of growth? If you look at the onshore market, if you break it up based on onshore and offshore, the CAGRs were tremendous in the last decade, but if you look from 08 through 12, it'll be, our view, double-digit CAGRs on land-based wind, but there are going to be some new growth regions, some growth opportunities. Canada, 40% CAGR. A feed-in tariff was just passed in Canada, 13.5 cents a kilowatt hour, and part of that requirement is local content. So we meet the local content. We've been in Canada. We've been operating in Canada for quite some time, and so we're well positioned there to grab that market. In Latin America, 70% CAGR there, in particular Brazil. Brazil just had an auction for 1.8 gigawatts. Of the portion that's been allocated to OEMs, such as ourselves, which is a little over a gigawatt, we've won over 40% of that. So again, local content, we have blade suppliers there, well positioned. Eastern Europe, 28% CAGR. And there, talked about the project with CEZ, our 2.5 megawatt machine. Europe's largest wind project is GE. And then in China and India, 20% CAGR. And just to calibrate you, of the 30% CAGR for wind and solar, wind was about 24 for the last decade. So those three markets, which are all very substantial in size, are growing at 2 to 3x what the last decade was for the entire market. So, and we believe we're well positioned. And if you look over from 2010 to 2012, the land-based wind market's $130 billion opportunity. So huge opportunity where differentiation is going to be your supply chain, your technology, and your product positioning. And just a comment on the supply chain. Our strategy, we're not vertically integrated on the components, we're vertically integrated on the design. So for example, our blades are our design, but we have multiple suppliers that make them for us. Our gearbox is our design, but we'll have multiple suppliers that will make them for us, as is our towers. So to get to Canada, for example, it's much easier for us to do that. We'll bring in 2 or 3 suppliers and very quickly get factories launched in these new markets, but it's with a partnership with a supplier. It's not with GE's capital. So very capital-efficient business model. Expanding into offshore. If you look at the offshore market, the first point I want to make here is a lot of interest in offshore, a lot of press on offshore, but there really hasn't been a lot of activity. And I can tell you, my experience to date has been every forecast for land-based wind came in a year earlier than planned. And every forecast for offshore wind slid a year to the right. So when you look at the offshore market, to date, of the 150 gigawatts of global capacity for wind, less than 2% of it is offshore. So it really hasn't existed. It's been more demonstration projects and a niche play. However, we see that changing, in particular in the North Sea, with the EU 20% by 2020 directive and the rollout to the different countries, in particular the UK, and what they're doing to build out an offshore infrastructure. We see this taking off, in particular, probably the 2012, 13, 14 through 2025 as a big build-out cycle, and we're positioning ourselves with a reliable leading product with a 4-megawatt machine. Last year, we acquired Scanwind, which is a Norwegian company that has a direct drive technology that complements very well what our capabilities are and something we can use to differentiate ourselves on this front here. And it gives us about a 2-year advantage on development cycle time. But between 2010 2020, we see about $100 billion of market size here, where the risks are extremely high, the financing needs are going to be very prudent, and so tier one suppliers are going to be at a premium. And this is a spot that we think we can differentiate ourselves in, and it will be a great growth area for us going forward. If you look at the installed base, we have, as I said, the single largest fleet of a individual unit, the 1.5-megawatt machine. We scaled that up from about 1,000 when we bought this in 2002 to 13,500, and if we didn't take another commitment, we'd probably hit 20,000. So this installed base is growing extremely rapidly. The off-warranty portion is growing at 45%. So when you start to look at the service opportunity, it's right around the corner. And we see this as a billion-dollar-a-year opportunity in the near term. A couple of points on where the streams will come from. One is parts and maintenance. And when you think of parts and maintenance traditionally, you may think low-tech. But remember the description, when you talk about return to service cycle time, we measure that in minutes. And so you do that remotely with software. And so being able to facilitate a service infrastructure that's smarter from a diagnostics perspective, centralized, and then implemented, decentralized, is the core part of that strategy. The other is upgrades. One particular example is called Wind Boost. And for the fleet of 13,500 units that are out there, they're rated at 1.5 megawatts. And not to take you through a design course in wind, but the wind farm, let's say you have a 100-megawatt wind farm, it can only produce 100 megawatts. That's what it's rated at. Most of the time, it won't be running at 100. So if you have 67 1.5-megawatt wind turbines, 30 of them may be running at 1.5 megawatts, 37 may be running at 1.2. So the whole farm is, say, at 80. We can, in that situation, with the controls change, allow those 30 that are running at 1.5 to run at 1.6. And then the whole farm, instead of running at 80, runs at 85. And when you run through the math, it's 4% more power. And it's a software change. It's an email. And the amount of value that that creates for our fleet is $750 million. So these are the kinds of things that we have our engineers working on relative to our installed base to continue to help our customers be more competitive in this market going forward. From a smart grid perspective, there's a lot of discussion on meters and, you know, demand-side management. We have a smart grid business unit, but our renewable platforms play right in that, and a big part of it is inverter technology. And as you continue to penetrate higher and higher levels of renewables, what you'll find is the ability for grid features, grid friendliness technologies, to be able to accomplish that will be a yes or no whether that project can go forward. And today, we have dozens of patents around our grid differentiating features and continue to invest in power electronics technology as we see this as a big differentiator. And the way to think about it is, how do you make a wind farm run like a traditional power plant? How do you make it more dispatchable, more robust to voltage variation, current variations, and something that fits into the grid more naturally? And we're positioned to do that because we have the gas, the steam, the nuclear, and the coal background and technology going forward. So something we're extremely excited about. And as you can see, we've got over 75 patents in this space. Looking forward, We're taking the breadth of GE, not just the thermal and power generation side, but our global research center on materials, things like advanced composites to make blades lighter, to help us give us an advantage on logistics costs and performance, transportation for advanced drivetrains, oil and gas, in particular in the offshore space, from the ocean floor up to the ocean surface. Our oil and gas business manages that very well, so we feel we can partner there. Aviation and energy financial services, we're bringing all those capabilities to bear in the alternative energy space on things like blade design, power conversion, drivetrains, and solar. And just to take a minute on solar, the solar business, our strategy is a technology strategy right now. Our view is the cost of solar is still too high for it to become mainstream. And when you look at the subsidies, for example, in Europe, in Germany, and in Spain, which drove the majority of the market run over the last several years, they were unsustainable, 40-plus cents a kilowatt hour. And a number that the German government has published is for the amount of solar that went in under those subsidies, which represents less than 1% of their electricity. The feed-in tariff obligation is over $85 billion. So it's something that at the costs that that technology is, it's just not sustainable to be scaled yet. So our focus on solar is we're extremely big on R&D, in particular thin film, and we acquired a company called Primestar, which is out in Golden, Colorado, and we're investing with them and our Global Research Center on making the world's most efficient CadTel module, which once we hit the targets we're interested in, that's when we believe it'd be cost-effective to scale out. So in summary, we'll just take some questions and have some discussion. You can see how we've scaled the business from $1 billion in 2003 to over $6 billion in 2009. What have been the keys to success? Focusing on customer value. This is to make a difference, to hit the targets of 10%, 15%, 20%. No one deal is going to make it. It's going to be a continued investment over essentially a generation. And so that's only going to be done with quality and true differentiation and having the best products. That's what we're focused on. So product leadership, technology differentiation, efficiency, reliability, low cost of energy, the basics, that's what's going to make this win. And right now the reason wind is the most scaled renewable out there is it's the most cost effective and the most reliable, something that we were right in the center of. Global supply chain, as each country looks for jobs, economic growth, the impact of their green energy economy, being able to bring a supply chain without having all the challenges associated with that and being able to do it with quality is key. We believe we've got the right business model there and flawless execution. And just to close on that, in the fall of fourth quarter of last year, we installed over 3,000 1.5-megawatt machines in 13 weeks. And so when you look at that, each section, each turbine has three tower sections, three blades, nacelle. This is big, heavy equipment, no OSHA recordables, 98% on time to customer want. So the ability to scale this business is something that often gets taken for granted. And the devil's in the details here, where we believe GE's execution capability, project management capability, and logistics cost make up 20% of the cost of a project. So keeping that in control has been a big differentiator for us as we scale this business. And currently, wind is the number one eco-imagination play in General Electric. So hopefully you found some of that useful, and now we'll just take some questions.
Okay.
Just curious, when you mentioned the smart grid for wind, just curious, when you think of the dedication out there politically, the private sector to get it done, we've been hearing about overhauling the grid in the U.S. for 15 years, 20 years, and it always seems like a very logical thing that will take place, but it is always a lot slower than you think. Your conviction that we will get a smart grid for wind, can you just give us some lay of the land, how you see that playing out?
What I will say is I think the grid transmission, let's start there, just transmission for renewables is a big problem for the country. And why is that? We've built an enterprise and a system now that was 10 gigawatts, right? You look in 2009, 10 gigawatts got plugged into the grid. That's 10 nuclear plants. Even if you take into account that it runs a third of the time, it's still 3 to 4 nuclear plants. So to maintain that, you need to be able to plug these alternative energy sources into the demand. There's a lot of headwind to get that done, mostly around permitting, regulation, ownership, cost, allocation. I think there's a tremendous amount of focus from trade associations and a lot of our customers trying to work this. I mean, in Texas, you see the CREZ line. How does smart grid help that? If you look at the challenge to getting, say, 100 gigawatts of grid added in to be able to dispatch renewables, how much can you do with what you have? And so the slide that I had on here said, for the same grid you have, I can put more energy through it because it's more efficient with how I manage the inverter. So our smart grid for wind is one that said, a line that exists with turbine A, I can't put it on there. With turbine B, I can, because of the smartness of the alternative energy source that I plug in. So that's our strategy to differentiate at the product level. And then relative to the total grid, we have a whole smart grid initiative looking at cities and business models for how that comes out.
In the renewable fuel business at $6 billion of revenues, what are the longer-term targets? If you look at 3 to 5 years, what kind of numbers are you referencing for growth?
Well, we don't, for individual business segments, we don't give revenue targets. But what I can tell you is the business has gone from $1 billion to $6 billion. We see the space is a several hundred billion dollar space when you take land-based wind and onshore wind, and we've got a lot of room to grow. So there's no reason you can't continue to grow this double digits. I think in 2010, 2011, if you look at the markets, just to talk through that for a second, the U.S. Probably going to be a little smaller going into 2010, depending on how they do the ITC grant, whether that gets extended from 10 into 11. You may see a pop in 11. So you see sort of the U.S. sort of plateauing. From a Canada perspective, going to grow like crazy. 40% CAGRs. Latin America growing at 70%. You look at India, has been sort of struggling somewhat, but we see that growing to be a couple gigawatt market. And Europe, the beauty for us in Europe is our share in Europe's been relatively small. We've seen all this growth in the U.S., and with Europe, we think we can grow share from our position.
Has the business reached a scale where it's a profitable business yet, or is it still a growth story, getting to the scale to be profitable?
I can't give you numbers, but it is profitable.
It is profitable. Okay. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about the technology roadmap for this from the perspective of GE being able to maintain a technology gap such that when you go into countries like a China or an India and you're doing domestic manufacturing, that the technology doesn't leak out and 5 years later the business is so competitive you can't make the margins you want?
Right. Great question. And it's our strategic discussion every day of the week. A couple of things. The way you differentiate yourself technically is you pick the location, you put my turbine up or somebody else's, mine captures more energy, right? So it's lowest cost of energy. That's what we're focused on. The way you're going to do that, blade technology plays a big part. And blade technology is one that, you know, if you take our aircraft business, we understand these kind of flows. We think we're advantaged there. Material science is extremely important. You know, this offshore turbine is 110 meters in diameter. So take a football field, you know, turn it vertical, slide it 50 stories in the air and spin it, and you get enough power for 1,000 homes and do that 3,000 times a year. I mean, there's a lot more to doing this with quality and reliably than you might think at first blush. The other part that I think is the most IP intensive is power conversion and controls. And the way to think about it is some of the biggest improvements we've made to reliability has been how you control the turbine. And wind is extremely variable. So how do you take a signal and then what do you do with that signal? how do you pitch the blades, how do you control loads, how do you control stresses, and those calculations and those models, we call them model-based controls, will determine if a turbine's going to last 3 years, 10 years, 20 years, and will also determine how much revenue that turbine's going to get over that cycle. And that is extremely IP intensive and difficult to copy unless you understand all the pieces and how they come together. So that's why our strategy has been, while components will be made by our supply chain and suppliers that we partner with, there are drawings. So we own that piece.
What percent of the business is financed by GE Capital and various forms of government for your annual sales?
You know, it's an interesting question. And remember, they would work with our customers, right? So we'll, what'll happen there is a project we may do with a developer. The developer may have used GE Capital to monetize the production tax credit or for some type of some financing. I don't know that number, but I can give you a sense. It's probably less than 10%. You know, it's not a big portion. And again, GE Capital is a separate business. They will work with our customers typically after the equipment's already been bought. It's more, they'll do it based on the economics of a project as they see it as an investment.
I was just thinking of dinner party conversation and about wind farms and the comment that's made that the amount of energy generated in building the products is more than is generated by the wind farms themselves, and that their length, that they only last for 30 years. I'm not sure whether that's correct or not. And so that the actual energy balance isn't nearly as positive as is made out. And I wondered if you could comment on that.
You know, I am familiar with the thought, and I have heard those numbers, but they're not fresh in my mind right now. But what I can tell you is I think for solar, the payback is in years. And the energy intensity to make a solar panel and then the amount of energy it collects and or converts, that payback is in years. With wind, it's relatively short. When you look at the amount, you know, 600 homes of power out of a turbine, I think it's a matter of months. I believe these are positive in well under a year. We can confirm that and get back to you, but those numbers aren't fresh in my head, but we have at our Global Research Center, we have those numbers. It's not a negative payback. It's clearly positive.
You made a comment early on that when something goes wrong with one of the turbines or in your center up in Schenectady, you can see when something's going wrong and try and tune it. Does every one of your contracts have that sort of sales and service type attachment to it? So in other words, you're managing it in addition to selling it to them?
No, not everyone. There's probably a little under half has it. And I think what you'll see is the evolution of this approach as it gets demonstrated is really the direction going forward. And I'll just give you a number. It's probably 14, 16 months out of date, but it's a good rule of thumb. And it tells you where the risks are in this industry. If I said I wanted to put a sticker in every nacelle, which is the turbine drivetrain, said I was here, I forgot to put that sticker in, it's $20 million. And you say, how could that be? The reason is you have to get to every turbine. These are in remote locations. And you have to climb it. Well, you can't climb alone. It's a enclosed space. Safety, OSHA reasons. I can only climb so many in a day. So you start to look at what happens, 13,500 units out there. For every point you move the world, you need 40,000. Just say that you get 5 more points of global growth from wind. It's 200,000 turbines. You can't manage these one at a time. It has to be a system. It has to be sort of a very sophisticated control center. And who best positioned to do that than the OEM? And then the other question is, when you get there, what part is in it? So configuration management. And you start to look at those core competencies of what this industry is going to need right around the corner. That's where we're investing. And we believe that will inherently be more competitive than a onesie, twosie approach at a macro level. So, you know, it's something we're taking very serious. And I think as customers see that play out, that's where the connections are going to be made.
Have you had a case where you've actually put them in and somebody else said, or the actual users say, we'll do the contract, we'll service them and monitor them, and they actually come back to you and say, we want you to do it?
I didn't understand, I'm sorry.
Well, as you describe it, you're monitoring half of them.
Yep.
And sort of, if you will, doing the maintenance. Of anybody that has not taken that up and taken it upon themselves, have any of them come back
and
said?
Yes, they have.
Okay.
They have. And I think it just we'll go through the history. We've had a very logical build-out approach here. And what problem are you trying to solve? And if you go back, the industry had a lot of issues in the early 2000 timeframe relative to quality, relative to business models. And as we worked through that, we focused on the product. And there were customers who felt they could do it a lot cheaper, and their performers had certain numbers in them. We had our views. After they've tried it for a period of time and the industry starts to learn what it takes to actually accomplish the level of performance that is needed to hit the performer, they're finding that you're able to do it more competitive partnering with the OEM. Not everybody. There are some very sophisticated operators out there that they're doing this in a very aggressive way, but we have had many come back after doing it themselves for a couple of years and say, can we work together?
One last question.
Is GE yet attempting to market wind as a system from the standpoint of also having gas turbines or other parts of the whole package? Is that something that you're ready to do or thinking about?
Great question. The answer is you need both. We have a lot of analysis on that. And when you look at, and this is the last question, right? So maybe I'll just end with this. One of the things that we led was the gas infrastructure. If you go back to 1995, the country had 600 gigawatts of power generation installed. It took 100 years to build it. From 95 to 2000, we shipped 200 gigawatts of natural gas turbines into the country, and we built a gas infrastructure. Reserve margins went from 9% to over 30. When you look at installing all this wind, it's a great hedge on gas. They complement each other very well. Gas is a flexible resource, and so in our gas turbines, we're seeing our customers ask for fuel flexibility and operability, which is essentially being able to follow a grid in a very effective way. Connecting an LMS 100, if you will, or an aeroderivative engine with a wind farm, we have the ability to do that. What we're finding is there isn't a project that typically starts from ground zero that says, give me one of those and one of these and do it together and let me dispatch it. But we're solving that problem with customers because many of them already have gas turbines. And so how do you connect the SCADA system for wind into my existing gas system so they complement each other? And so we're working more that way than building a lot of new demonstration projects that start from ground zero. But I think long term, these two complement each other very nicely.
So. Would you have the Edison more than virtually?
Yeah, I think that's where firm renewable power. How do you get firm renewable power? I think that's a piece. Another piece is, you know, when you look at storage, you know, the plug-in hybrid question: does the transportation sector begin to put a demand on off-peak power? you start to see that happen, you're going to see a demand curve that's going to be very exciting. There's a lot of ways that this plays out going forward. How it plays out, I'm not sure I know, but we've got those scenarios technically in our head.
Thank you.
Okay.
It's a 20-minute break.
Great.
And we'll be back here at 3:30 for the next presentation. Again, the library right here has got all the refreshments you need out this door and the restrooms.
Thanks.